Good evening once again, friends and listeners. Welcome to the October 20th, 2014 edition of the Heretics Hour. I'm Carolyn Yeager, your host. I read something this week which I thought pertained to my thinking about this program today. So I'm going to read it to you. It was actually about Christopher Columbus saying that he was a Christian European supremacist. But then it went on to say, how else does civilization progress if not through the imposition by superior men of superior ideas? And what great nation, what great empire, what great civilization ever rose on a belief in the equality of all other peoples and all other faiths? So I know that many of you, or most of you listening to me, would agree with that. Then it's all a question of how it's applied, you know? Who are the great nations, and who are the great civilizations, and who are the superior men, and which are the superior ideas? However, another thought came to me as I was working on this, or probably reading something in the news, which I'm not going to be able to give any news stories today, because although there were some interesting ones, because I've got quite a lot of material here. And I'll just say right off the bat that I'm not going to ask for phone callers until maybe towards the end if I get through all of this, because I don't really want to leave anything out tonight. I've had a whole week to prepare for this, and so I keep preparing more. In fact, today I added a few things. So that's the way that goes. So I'm not even going to announce the phone number right now, but I might do it later. But I do want to tell you that I've got my email open, and I did ask Carolyn at carolynyeager.net, and I did get some good, two good emails from Stuart last week, which I read, and I thought they were very helpful to the show. So I'll be trying to remember to check that. I do intend to, no matter what, play some music at the 1 hour mark between this 2 hour show, in the middle of this 2 hour show, and so I'm not going to skip it for anything. So when I do that, hopefully I will think to go look at my email, if not before. Yeah, I thought as I was reading the news, what I'd like to see, I would really like to see this experiment. To put a big wall around Germany, or somehow just pluck Germany out from Europe for a year and let the EU function without it. How would Europe do? How would the Slavs do without Germany? How would everybody do? I would love to see the results of that experiment. Of course, if you put a wall around Germany and the Germans are there, remain there, they would have problems. Also, to be cut off from the rest of Europe, probably because if they didn't export, they wouldn't be able to import either. So, you know, they would have some difficulty. They do need to import food, for one thing, but I think they'd manage. I think they could manage. I would, not that it's going to happen, but that's something that I think about fairly often. All right, last week's program is what led to this one, since this is part two. From last week, and what happened was that on after last week's program, like probably around Tuesday, I was looking at the upcoming material for a table talk that was read on this past Thursday, and I found this interesting material in there. I thought it was real interesting, especially this conversation with Hitler, of course, and with Reichsführer SS Heinrich Himmler about various things, including Germanization of the Eastern territories and also even in the West. I started thinking, boy, reading about it, and I thought, I've got to get into that. And so I decided to do this program today to continue with it today, and I've been finding more stuff all week. Last week, I spoke about the reasons for Chancellor Adolf Hitler to invade Poland on September 1st, 1939, and also for the invasion of Russia 2 years later. It was not something he wanted to do, as I pointed out, but was forced to do by, well, I would say a conspiracy of foreign powers, if that's not too strong a language. I told the whole story. Well, here's what I want to say. And try to explain why the whole story about brutal aggression and desire for world domination by Hitler and his National Socialist Nation was false and is false, and a few other things that we got into on those scores. And now I'm going to tackle those prevailing beliefs that Hitler lost the war because of his failure to use the what order always portrayed as enthusiastic and ready to go and ready to fight Slavic peoples like Ukrainians, Czechs, Russians, and even Poles to fight the Soviet Union, whom they hated. Well, it's just not that easy, I don't think. And so some of this, we'll be looking at that in this program tonight. In Mein Kampf, Hitler spoke about his experiences in Vienna when he questioned if and how far the Slavs possessed the necessary capacity for constructive politics. That's what he wrote then. And Mein Kampf was written, started, I think, in 1922 or 23 and completed in 1926 before he, as he said, he had no conception he would ever become chancellor at that time. He just wanted to, although he maybe had, you know, he hoped for everything, but he said he wouldn't have written the book if he had known that he would have, his things would have turned out the way they did. Although we're all happy he wrote the book, I think it's really important that we have it. And anyway, how he felt about the Slavs, as he said at that time, because of his experiences in Vienna, which was a multiracial society, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, but he was in the Austrian part. But the national parliament was in Vienna, and so there were a lot of, particularly Czechs there, but a lot of other nationalities, Slavic nationalities. And he thought it made for, he said that he desired the end of this state before the Slavic mixture stamped out its German character. He is very strong in loving and also appreciating the German character and thinking it was the best. It was the best, and he didn't want it to be wiped out or overwhelmed by what he considered the Slavic character or mixture. So he said, I think this is really why he wanted to move to Germany so much at that time. He was so happy when he finally managed to move to Munich and got out of Austria. It was for that reason. Now, I want to give an explanatory note here before I start in with this. That is the idea of the Aryan master race and the German master race. And there's a common idea that the Germans, the feeling that Germans were the Aryan Herrenvolk, which is always translated as master race, was widely spread among the German public through, this is what they say like in Wikipedia and so on, although this came from William Shirer's book, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. You know how terrible that book is. And this is the idea that's always put out there, that the National Socialists themselves spread the idea that they were the master race, and they tried to convince the German people that's what they were, and use Nazi propaganda, etc. It is said that they quote Reichskommissar of Ukraine after 1939, of course. In fact, this is from 1943, supposedly. The Ukraine Reichskommissar, the German, said, "We are a master race, which must remember that the lowliest German worker is racially and biologically 1,000 times more valuable than the population here. that's the kind of thing that we get. I don't know what Cook said, but he was known to be a bit extreme. But master race should be translated as leading race. I've come across Germans. I think it's in what I'm going to cover tonight. In one case, unless that part was not included, but where someone called I think it was Himmler in a speech called the Germans the leading race of Europe, and there's a big difference between leading race and master race. See, but that's one of those areas where the way that they translate something totally distorts the meaning that the Germans had for it. So I just thought I'd bring that up, because I'm going to go now to this section from last week's reading of Table Talk that I just told you about, and I'm going to go through it because I think it's, even though we did it on Thursday, we didn't have time we don't have time to really consider one little section that much and go on and on about it. So I commented very briefly, a point. I'm going to direct your attention to it more tonight because it's something that could be seen as negative, as I said on Thursday. I don't think it's negative, and I think we need to understand these things in the proper way and also understand what Hitler and his people were trying to do. Let's not hide from that because we think it sounds too harsh. So in this case, we have Henry Picker taking the notes during the dinner conversation. And Henry Picker writes, "During dinner, the Reichsführer SS declared that, in his view, the best way of settling the French problem would be to carry off every year a certain number of racially healthy children chosen amongst France's Germanic population." He means that even in France, there are people of good French people of good German blood in them, and Himmler was more tuned in to German blood, wherever it was, how valuable it was, and should be preserved and brought to the German nation than anybody else was, it seemed. He thought about that quite a bit. And he said it would be necessary to try, well, the note taker is quoting him, is saying that he said it would be necessary to try to settle these children while still very young in German boarding schools, to train them away from their French nationality, which was due to chance, he says. This is a case where they just by chance ended up there, to make them aware of their Germanic blood and thus inculcate into them the notion of their membership of that great group of Germanic peoples. And then there's a footnote. There was a note written on the page by Bormann after this. Bormann called this a sinister theory. Fuhrer wasn't so crazy about it. But it then goes on to what Adolf Hitler says, and this is supposedly directly from him. "For my part, all these attempts at Germanization don't mean much to me." There you go. "Insofar, at least, as no successful attempt is made to found them on an appropriate conception of the world." Well, I think that he means by that you have to really understand the quality of these people, that if they are really German, genetically German people, then Germanization might work, but otherwise it's not going to work so well. I also want to say that he said on another occasion, speaking with generals, immediately prior, it was in 1933 or 32, immediately prior to becoming chancellor, he said to the generals that people could not be Germanized, only the soil could be. In other words, it seems to be saying that only a German can be a German, that you have to clear out an area and then put Germans in it. And then you Germanize the area, but you can't exactly take people, and he's not quite sure you can do that and Germanize them. Anyway, he then goes on and says, "As regards France, One must not forget that the military reputation of that country is not due to the people's moral worth, but essentially to the fact that on the continent, the French were able to exploit certain military combinations of circumstance that were favorable to them. During the 30 Years' War, for example, every time they were confronted by a Germany that was aware of herself, they got a thrashing under Frederick the Great, for example, and in 1940, under him, of course. He doesn't say that, but the fact that they won victories of universal significance under the leadership of that unique military genius, the Corsican Napoleon, makes no difference at all. They point out that he points out that he's Corsican. The mass of the French people has petty bourgeois spiritual inclinations, so much so that it would be a triumph to succeed in removing the elements of Germanic origin from the grasp of the country's ruling class. By which I think he means that they're already too far gone, or they're, you know, too Frenchified and petty bourgeois. So he doesn't know that that would succeed too well. Now I want to interject here that I came upon something else this week, and a German person from the past who is supposed to be an expert on Germanics, and his list of the modern Germanic peoples of Europe include these groups. First, of course, the Germans and the Austrians, but then after that, the English, probably the largest, one of the larger groups, most numerous, and along with the English, those who speak the Scots language in Scotland. I don't know enough about Scotland to understand that, but I read there are three languages that the Scots speak. One of them is English, and another one is something else, and the Scots language is supposedly a Germanic language, but I don't know why the rest of the Scots would be also. I never have understood just what the Scots are kind of a mixture. They're part Celt and different things. Maybe that's mostly what it is. So you have those. Then also, after that, the Dutch. I mean, the Dutch are actually, you know, Deutsch. I mean, they're the closest to Germans. They're the same as Germans. There is no difference between the Dutch and the Germans, but the Dutch don't like the Germans, strangely, just like the English don't, at least, you know, the mass of them. And they really want to stay separate. That's how it is with people when you're very much alike and you decide we're a different group from you, and we don't want anything to do with you. So, and along with the Dutch, you have the Flemish, which is a smaller group, but then the Afrikaners, which are Dutch, kind of a Dutch-German type, Dutch-German-y people. And that's all the same thing. So they're Germanic, too. And then the Frisians, which are supposedly in the Netherlands, live in the Netherlands, but they're also said to be more like more Danish. But they're a supposedly kind of a Dutch group or Danish group that doesn't relate at all to the rest of the Dutch and doesn't want to, and sees himself as totally unlike anybody else and just on their own there. But they're also Germanic. And then, of course, you have the Norwegians and the Swedes, two big countries, and the Danes and the Icelanders. So that's a lot of, that's a large group of people, of Europeans who are considered Germanic people. And that's what would be referred to as we go on talking about the Germanics here. And Britain goes, the Welsh and the Irish are Celtic for the most part, although the Welsh are also kind of mixed. So now it goes on, the Henry Picker, the note taker, says thereupon, after Hitler said what he said, the Reichsführer SS turned the conversation upon his experience with Mussert, the leader of the Dutch nationalists. And he was, you know, real loyal, so to speak, national socialist who had come now to some prominence in the Netherlands since it was occupied by the Germans. And the Reichsführer SS says, what struck me is that Mussert is trying to get back his legion. He tried to explain to me that to provide a military safeguard for his seizure of power in Holland, he needed the Dutch Legion, which at present is fighting on the Eastern Front. I let him have no hopes on that score, pointing out to him, on the contrary, that once the war was over, he could have in Holland only the number of soldiers corresponding to the strength of the legionaries at present fighting on the Eastern Front. For territorial defense, he has no need of a federal Dutch army, since after the war, this defense will be exclusively our business. Nor is it necessary to maintain an important federal army for show purposes. So there he's saying, and it's probably agreed upon, that when they would have this Germanic Union or Germanic order in Europe, which is only being talked about, there's no reality to it, it's just an idea, that these various countries don't need to have their own army. They need to have a certain defense, certain number for defense, but the army, the protection and the defense of the area of Europe will be a common effort of which would be coming out of Germany as the main power, and the others would of course participate too, and they would have one army for all of Europe. So that's one a little more information there that people might not like and say, well, we're going to, you know, they're going to take us over. Now, the Fuhrer then gave his opinion. He said, Mussert expressed himself in a rather curious fashion in my presence on the subject of the oath taken by the legionaries. That's why I asked him whether he supposed it was in sheer lightness of heart that I divided my Austrian homeland into several Gau, in order, that is, districts, in order to remove it from separatist tendencies and incorporate it more easily into the Germanic Reich. And so that is, he means that was to discourage any easy facility of becoming independent again. Say Austria, not that he didn't trust it, but, you know, it was divided into Gaus, just like Germany was divided into Gaus. And so each Gau had its own kind of, district administration, and Gauan administration, and each one was incorporated into the Reich, into the larger Reich, rather than taking all of Austria and saying, okay, now we're attaching you, and it was still kind of a whole entity that could say, well, now we've decided later on we want to become unattached. So that was just a little bit of a way of making it harder for them to go back to what they were. So, you know, all these things are being thought about. And Hitler says, has not Austria, too, her own history, just like the Netherlands does, which seems as though Mussert was telling him, well, I'm a little concerned about, we need to have our army here, you know, I need to have the army here. And Hitler didn't like that, and he's saying, he's using the example of Austria and saying that Austria had just as much independent history as the Netherlands does. And he says, secular five times over, a history that truly is not devoid of highlights. They didn't do nothing, you know, they did a lot. Obviously, in discussing these problems, one must remain very careful when confronted by Dutch and Norwegians. One must never forget that in 1871, Bavaria would never have agreed to become part of Prussia. Bismarck persuaded her only to agree to become part of a great association linked by kinship, that is to say, Germany. He's saying that instead of Bavaria joining Prussia, which they wouldn't do, they made out that Bavaria and Prussia were both coming together in this new Germany. So that made it okay. And that's just so much the way you present things. It's like in with corporations, we know when corporations merge, sometimes they merge their name, you know, so the new name of the corporation becomes a combination of a part of each of the two. Or sometimes it stays one of the companies and the other one loses its name, and that's when the other one is more is more brought into the other and really loses its identity. So those are some, I think those are pretty good examples of how this works and how you make it keep everybody happy and feel like they're being recognized. So Hitler goes on, nor did I, in 1938, tell the Austrians that I wanted to incorporate them in Germany, but I insisted on the fact that Germany and Austria ought to unite to form the Greater German Reich. Similarly, when speaking to the Germanics of the North, West, and North, that is, he's talking about the European countries, Norway, Netherlands, and Denmark, and so on, one must always make it plain that what we're building is the Germanic Reich, or simply the Reich, with Germany constituting merely her most powerful source of strength, as much from the ideological as from the military point of view. So he's telling us right here, what he was willing to do and what not. And he saw Germany as taking the greatest responsibility for assuring the defense of the Reich, and he wanted to make sure that the ideological basis remained under the control of Germany. Two, if you take the greatest amount of responsibility, you're going to have the greatest amount of leadership or say-so. So that's the way he was doing that. But it was, you can understand that. Obviously, the way it would be done. But you have to, he's saying we have to present this. Not that any way that they presented it would have been agreeable to these countries. It wouldn't have been, but they were hoping, they were planning, thinking about how it could work out, what would work out. So then the picker, the note taker, writes again, the Reichsführer SS underlined these last words of the Führer's, emphasizing that amongst the various populations assembled in Holland, there was no real sense of belonging to one community. Here he brings up the Frisians. It's observed, for example, that the Dutch Frisians don't feel attracted, as far as kinship is concerned, towards the other Dutch, nor does one find in them a Dutch national sentiment founded on a solid idea of the state. Now, I'm going to say right here that what they were talking about was to give everybody, for everyone to have the sense that they were Germanic, to push that idea of Germanic to all these peoples and all these countries so that they would feel at home and they would feel like they belonged to this Germanic Reich. And I already commented on how much success I thought they'd have with that, but it all would depend on how other things turned out, which the way they did turn out wouldn't have. Under other circumstances, it might work, So this is still Henry Picker telling us what was said there. He says the Reichsführer SS then spoke of the creation in Holland of boarding schools for the political education of the young, two for boys and one for girls, to be called Reich schools, a title approved by the Führer. A third of the pupils would be Dutch and two-thirds German. After a certain period, the Dutch pupils would have to visit, in turn, a similar school in Germany. The Reichsführer SS explained that to guarantee that instruction would be given in accordance with the purposes of the Germanic Reich, he had refused the financial contribution from Holland and had asked Schwarz, who was the National Socialist Party treasurer, who Hitler had been talking about and bragging and praising previously in table talk, and he had asked Schwarz to set aside a specific sum exclusively for the financing of these schools. There was a project, again, if you're paying for it, you've got the say-so. So that's what they're doing there. He says there is a project for the creation of similar schools in Norway. They, too, would be financed solely by the Reich Party treasurer, Schwarz. This is Himmler. If we want to prevent Germanic blood from penetrating into the ruling class of the peoples whom we dominate, and subsequently turning against us, we shall have gradually to subject all our precious Germanic elements to the influence of this instruction. And the Führer approved of this point of view. Now, this is important to understand that, and I think it's pretty clear, but I'll just comment on it, that they want to make sure that they train these boys and girls in the right way of thinking, and as to be members of the Reich and to be used to thinking that way, that they are all members. And you notice that they have twice as many Germans in a class as Dutch, to make sure that the Dutch don't take over and dominate and get break into something different from what's being taught, and that if the Germans are dominating, then it's more likely that the Dutch will go along with the Germans, and that would be more successful from Hitler and Himmler's point of view, naturally. And I don't see anything wrong with that either. It's just the way you would have to do it, the way you would think. And then they'd also, after a while in these schools in Holland, then the Dutch pupils would go to a school in Germany itself. And this would guarantee that they would get a good foundation in the right kind of thinking as Germanic members of the Germanic Reich, who were full members, who belonged, and all of that kind of thing. Because this is very important to Hitler, and therefore to Himmler. I think Himmler adopted and adapted to what Hitler thought. So what was very important that they understood was that everybody was doing this voluntarily. They didn't want to force anybody in their Reich that was, you know, felt forced and not happy and comfortable and didn't think they belonged or really thought they belonged somewhere else. They never wanted anything like that also in their fighting troops, in their army. They didn't want that. They wanted everyone to be fully on board with the cause and with the fact that they were fighting with the group that they thought was their group. So they didn't want any doubts. So Hitler then says, "In any case, we must not commit the mistake of enlisting in the German army foreigners who seem to us to be worthwhile fellows, unless they can prove that they're utterly steeped in the idea of the Germanic Reich." So there you go, he makes that very clear. They're not, once they feel that they're really a part of the Germanic Reich, then they're not foreigners anymore. But if they have some kind of foreign perspective that they don't, not 100%, then Hitler says, we don't want to enlist them. We don't want to list them in the German army, even. And I know in previous times I said, well, they took in a lot of people. Well, they really needed, if it's just for the army, you can take in anybody, well, to go out there and fight. But no, he didn't see it that way. And a lot of that, that might have happened somewhat in 44 and 45 when there's, you know, things were so bad. Anybody, you put anybody out there, but this was his idea, that it was always Germans or people who thought they were Germans or believed they were Germans and were of the same mind and felt that they were fighting for their own battle there. And he says, while we're on the subject, I'm skeptical about the participation of all these foreign legions in our struggle on the Eastern Front. So now he's telling Himmler, while he's there, they're talking, he says, well, while we're on this subject, I want you to know that I'm skeptical about the participation of all these foreign legions in our struggle on the Eastern Front. One mustn't forget that unless he is convinced of his racial membership of the Germanic Reich, the foreign legionary is bound to feel that he's betraying his country. I've said somewhere, well, in the last week, it was got real clear to me, that it was Himmler who built up these foreign divisions. And they're a good idea. I mean, it's good. Himmler was very, well, he was an energetic guy. He was very gung-ho and thinking of good ideas all the time. And And it wasn't, I don't think it was Hitler who came up with this, those ideas at all. It was Himmler. And then he got Hitler's approval for them. But Hitler was always a little bit concerned about it. Maybe not of some, you know, once they got going and so on, but some of them. But it's just the opposite of what people like Veronica Clark are trying to make out, that he was just open to all these races and different nationalities and so on. And he wasn't at all. Now, and here Hitler shows that he thinks there has to be a racial connection, a racial bond. Well, he keeps bringing up the Germanic part, you know, in order for people to work together and in order for people to have countries together and so on. That's what that's always comes up from the very beginning of when he wrote in Mein Kampf, his very early speeches, and to the end of his life. He never veered from this. He never changed, always emphasizing how important race was. He wasn't just talking about white race, although often he mentioned the white race. He cared about the whole white race. He saw the value of the whole white race, naturally, as opposed to the non-white. But when he talked about racial, the Germanic racial bond, he was talking about Germanic. So then Hitler goes on. The fall of the Habsburg monarch clearly shows the full size of this danger. On that occasion, too, he says, it was thought the other peoples could be won over, Poles, Czechs, etc., by giving them a military formation in the Austrian army, which is what was done. The Poles were given a division of all made up of themselves, and the Czechs too, made up a division. But Hitler says, yet at the decisive moment, it became obvious that precisely these men were the standard bearers of rebellion. That's why it's no longer appropriate to build the Germanic Reich under the standard of the old Germany. It's not possible to unite the Germanic peoples under the folds of the black, white, and red flag of the old German Empire, for the same reason as prevented the Bavarians from entering the German Reich in 1871 under the flag of Prussia. It's the reason why I began by giving the National Socialist Party, as a symbol of the union of all Germanics, a new rallying sign, which was valid also inside our own national community, the swastika flag. Well, I kind of question whether he had that in mind at the time he designed the swastika flag and it was made and used and so on, whether he was thinking about uniting all these other people, European people who are Germanic under that banner, but he's saying that now anyway, and he thinks that that works best, that everybody can be united under the swastika flag. And, of course, these what are called the foreign legions, the other European SS divisions, the Norwegian, the Netherlandish, and so on and so forth, they had no problem with the swastika flag, I don't think. So, anyway, that's how he sees it working. And then he speaks a word of caution by saying, let's avoid attempting the Germanization of our vital space on too great a scale. Let's be cautious, especially with the Czechs and the Poles. So, you know, he doesn't want to move too fast in all of this. He says, according to Himmler, history proves that the Poles have their nationality tattooed on their bodies. They must, therefore, be kept under control by giving them the strongest possible stiffening of German officers and NCOs and by trying to have them outnumbered by the German students. So here he's saying that we can Germanize Czechs and Poles too, but we have to be extra cautious with them, because they've been so anti-German, and you know, they've had a totally different outlook and so on. So he says, it was agreed with Frank, the Governor General of occupied Poland, this is Hitler speaking, that the Krakow district with its purely German capital and also the Lublin district should be peopled by Germans. So that's what they were going to do there. And he says once these two weak spots have been strengthened, it should be possible to drive the Poles slowly back. So he's talking about the Poles that can't be Germanized. They're just talking still, but you know they take the ones that can be Germanized. And let me just say that there's this idea that there's a lot of Polish blood in Germans. Well, the truth is there's a lot of German blood in Poles, and there's a lot of Germans who became Polonized for various reasons and think that they're Polish. This is what I've read, that they think that they're Polish and they're loyal to Poland. They're absolutely, you know, but genetically, they're more German than Polish. But they don't even know it, you see. And that's, so it works both ways, you know. It works both ways. So he says, I don't believe it's necessary to proceed with much circumspection in this field, for we would be condemning ourselves to renew an experience we already had after the divisions of Poland. So he says, we're not going to go back. We're not going to make mistakes that bring us back to where we used to be after we've gone through all of this fighting and loss of German blood and to get to where we are now. We're not going to condemn ourselves to experience it again. He says the soul of Poland remained lively because on the one hand, the Poles hadn't to take the Russian domination seriously, and on the other hand, they succeeded in putting themselves politically in a strong position with the Germans, being helped in this by their allegiance to a Catholicism deeply tinged with politics. One can even say that the Poles played a decisive role in German home policy. I'm not sure what he's referring to there. And this last part is in parentheses. One can even say that the Poles played a decisive role in German home policy. And I'm not sure who's supposed to be saying that, if Hitler or if the note taker. Probably should be Hitler, but I'll go on because I'm not real clear about that. It's very important for the future that the Germans don't mingle with the Poles so that the new Germanic blood may not be transmitted to the Polish ruling class. And here's another issue that comes up, that they feel that Germanic blood is better blood, better than Polish, and if the Poles get hold of a lot of Germanic blood in the people who I just said who consider themselves Polish and who are in the Polish ruling class, intellectual class, and so on, with Polish names, it's just going to make the Poles stronger. They don't want the Poles to be a strong nation as an enemy nation or as a competitive nation anymore. You know, they're done with that. They're not going to allow that anymore, they're saying. That's what they're talking about here. And he says Himmler is right when he says that the Polish generals who genuinely put up a serious resistance in 1939, because this is, see, now it's 1942, April, and who put up a serious resistance in 1939 were, so to speak, exclusively of German descent. It's an accepted fact that it's precisely the best elements of our race who, as they lose awareness of their origin, forget that they're German, and just the same as with the Germans who come to the United States, you see, and who become Americans, you know, and forget about their Germanness. Well, he says it's precisely the best elements of these people who add themselves to the ruling class of the country that has welcomed them. As for the elements of less value, they retain the characteristics of their ethnic group and remain faithful to their Germanic origins. And the same caution is necessary towards the Czechs. They're skilled at not awakening the distrust of their occupiers and are wonderful at playing the role of subjects. He says, it's true they've had 5 centuries experience of it. I saw them at work in Vienna during my youth. He means the Czechs. Arriving penniless and dragging their worn-out shoes over the streets of the city, they quickly acquired the Viennese accent, and one fine day one was quite surprised to see them installed in the key positions. He's comparing the Poles and the Czechs, and that the Czechs are able to fit in and kind of secretly pretend like they're one of you when they're not really, whereas the Poles are really the ones who don't do that. And so they're more, they might be more honest about it, but they're always resisting. They never fit in. They don't want to fit in. Then he says, last paragraph, folks, we shall not win the peace on the racial level unless the Reich knows how to maintain a certain stature. Confronted with the United States, whose population is scarcely greater than ours, our strength lies in the fact that 4/5 of our people are of Germanic race. So once again, he makes it clear that he thinks the Germanic race is the superior one. And you might say again what I brought up in the beginning, the leading race, or a leading race for sure, but not a master race. And he never forgets the importance of this. Now, to me, what I've just gone through has all been about self-defense. It's not hatred. It's not about hatred at all. It's not about being against people just because you're against them. It's about saying we have put up with a lot from these Slavic people, from the Poles and the Czechs is all they're talking about here. And we're not going to allow that to continue. So we're taking the necessary measures so that our nation and our people can live out its destiny, because that's our interest. We're not here to provide for them to have their desired destiny, but for us to have our desired destiny. And, of course, we all understand that when it comes, all white people, white nationalists understand that when it comes to whites versus non-whites. But they don't understand it when it comes to one group of whites and another group of whites who don't see eye to eye or don't work together that well. So, well, there's more to go into about all this, so I'll move along. Before I play some music, I'm just going to read a little portion from next week. I have a longer one, but I'm not going to read it all. I see that I'm running out of time. So just one short paragraph that also has to do with Czechs and Poles that I was reading ahead for what we'll do on Thursday. So I'm just going to read this one little paragraph. In politics, the use of that little word, if, must be avoided. Where should we be today if the Czechs had had a little imagination? Or if the Poles had been realists and had gone about their affairs with a little more honesty? It is precisely the fact that the Pole is a dreamer and the Czech is an out-and-out realist which has enabled us swiftly and successfully to establish the new order in the territories formerly known as Czechoslovakia and Poland. He's saying that the Czechs don't have enough imagination, but they are very realistic about things, and that's why they behaved the way they did. They went along with the German idea, even though they didn't like it, but they went along with it, whereas the Poles would never go along with it, and the Poles have too much imagination and not enough sense of reality. They're really gone when it comes to keeping themselves in reality, and we're going to look at that. I'm going to read to you from a webpage that has been online for quite some time called DanzigFreeState.org, and actually it's a page from that site by Elsa Loser, an HTML page. I'll give you all that information after I play a little music for our break. And I'm going to play here something that is well known. It's a SS song, Wenn alle untreu werden, when all are untrue. You know, it's a song about loyalty. We remain loyal. We remain steadfast, and so on. So it is only last 2 minutes and 4 seconds, so it'll be over pretty quick. So here it is.
Wenn alle untreu werden, das Kinder noch verfehlt für euch ein Feld, ein Tal. Der Herde kommt bei Ruhen, die Kinder werden verteilt. Die Kunst und Blätter tun und sie wird tot gewalt. Der Herde kommt bei Ruhen,
Carolyn Yeager on the Heretics Hour on October 20th, 2014. I was telling you about this webpage called, the website called donsacreestate.org. And they say on that page, the present government of Germany as the successor of the German Third Reich, with the Third Reich being named as the aggressor against Danzig Germany, now declares that she is neither willing or able to formally take any responsibility as to the present unresolved situation as far as the territory of the Free City of Danzig is concerned, nor does Germany even think to consider resolving this very pressing, legally embarrassing matter with the Polish Republic. And I wanted to tell you that this whole website is the responsibility of Ernst F. Christner, I think that's how it's pronounced, and he's had it up since, he said, 1996, continually. So he goes, so on this Danzig site, it says, as there is no action forthcoming on the part of the German government to resolve once and for all and every legal questions about the territory of the Free City of Danzig, especially now that the Republic of Poland has been accepted as a member state of the European Union, the Polish Republic is very happy to let sleeping dogs lay. The centuries-old Polish wish, dream, and desire of having taken possession of a prime piece of real estate, namely the territory of the Free City of Danzig, and with it the Danzig seaport, seems to have come finally true, as there is seemingly no challenge coming from anyone, least of all from Germany. We, the autochthonic earliest known inhabitants of our rightful Danzig territory, have been dispossessed of all our earthly goods and of our territory. This was done by way of ethnic cleansing of the entire Danzig population as carried out by communist Polish regime that did expel everyone of Germanic blood by way of force, by way of mass starvation, and in most cases at the point of the gun from our territory. And as to our website in English, that has been in operation without a break since early 1996. Therefore, no excuses can be made for the UN not to know about us. This applies especially so to some of our postings directed to the UN and also mailed by way of registration to UN headquarters in New York and to the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights in Geneva, and so on. So he's saying that they know about it. You know, nobody pays attention to things like this, but they keep going with it. And the first item on this on their main page, which is the list, it has a whole lot of pages you can go to read things. Very, very good. Is this page put together in 1981 by Elsa Loeser, L-O-E-S-E-R, and it's at HTTP. Colon double forward slash www.danzigfreestate, all one word, .org/loeser.html, L-O-E-S-E-R, Loeser. Don't forget the HTML. You have to have that if you want to get to this page. But the title of it is Poland and Falsifications of Polish History. I came upon this page six, seven, 8 years ago or so. And I was recommending it to people at the time. I found it really interesting and helpful. And then I lost track of it, never even thought about it for a long, long time. And suddenly it came to my mind, and I was, I thought, I couldn't remember a thing about it. I couldn't remember the name or anything. I couldn't find it. And then somebody, just in the middle of this week, over at Daily Stormer, some commenter, posted the link to this, saying that this was, you know, of interest. I couldn't believe it. I recognized it right away. And I was so happy. I'm very happy to find this page again. So I'm going to read just a few sections from it because it's important. For me, this woman is speaking from experience and from her research when it comes to history. And she's speaking of that which she knows. And again, she's not speaking out of hatred. But this is highly critical of Poland, but not to be critical, but to tell what Poland has been doing and what they've been up to. All these, several hundred years, and why what happened to them did happen to them. They had it coming, you know. So she says, I would like to begin with a few remarks about myself personally, for the purpose of explaining why I am so familiar with circumstances in Poland. I was born and grew up in former Congress Poland, which was at that time annexed to Tsarist Russia. Both my own experiences and those of my forefathers date back to the period prior to the First World War. I learned a great deal from reports from my parents and grandparents, and much from my own experience. My family only settled in Bromberg, West Prussia, after the First World War. Many thousands of German families unwilling to live in a Polish state, because after the First World War, they created the Polish state because, take a lot of territory away from Germany. So the Poles now had their own republic again, which they didn't have before that. You know, they were changing boundaries all over the place, and all these Germans were living there. It was Germany, it was West Prussia. And the boundaries were very much further to the east. So many thousands of German families didn't want to live under Polish government, so they were moving to West Prussia. What happened was that when they were attempting to reach the German Reich by moving to territory granted to Germany by plebiscite, but after the first territories subjected to plebiscites achieved overwhelming majorities, of up to 97 and 98% to be German, the Poles prevented all further plebiscites to take place in the territory that was under their control. So she writes, Upper Silesia, despite a clear German majority, was terrorized by Polish rebellions, during which time German residents were repeatedly attacked for so long that Upper Silesia was partitioned by the League of Nations as a result of French pressure and French extortion. West Prussia was therefore lost without a plebiscite. We were therefore forced to become Polish citizens. So she says, I experienced life in Poland and suffered enough there to be well aware of the Polish national character from my own experience. In Germany, people know very little or absolutely nothing of the nature and objectives of the Poles. All sorts of lies and slanders are naively accepted as revealed truths. I would therefore like to educate people in this regard, since eventual understanding can only come about as a result of an exact knowledge of the history and development of the Poles. Truth on both sides is a precondition to any reconciliation. As long as one side continues to lie without restraint and the other is compelled to keep silent for whatever reason, there will be no reconciliation and no reparation of injustice. Lies destroy all approach to reconciliation. Only the truth on both sides can exert a healing influence. Well, you know, I'm just 100% on board with that. And I've always seen it that way, and I don't think we have that at all. She writes, I therefore wish to make the Poles comprehensible to you in their cruel reality, in all their doings. In so doing, I must also discuss the historical facts. An evil proverb referred to the eternal enmity between Poles and Germans and has existed among the Polish people for decades. The proverb states, Well, she gives it in Polish and then translates it as long as the world exists, a Pole will never be a brother to the German. A truly malicious saying, which has no equivalent in German-speaking regions. This proverb is an expression of the great vehemence of Polish hatred. Well, think about this. You know, she says it's a Polish proverb that's used a lot. As long as the world exists, a Pole will never be a brother to the Germans. So that cuts off any reconciliation. That cuts off any overcoming of whatever the problem is. And this is not new from World War II or anything. This is an old one because she says it's existed for decades that she knows of. So it's this antagonism and hatred for Germans goes way back in Polish history. It's interesting, to say the least, as to why it is, because Germans have always been helpful to the Poles, but of course the real reason is because the Germans have always been superior to the Poles, and the Poles are always needing the help of the Germans, and she says that the one who needs help always is hates the person who gives them the help, even though they take it. So she talks about how hatred is foreign to the German soul and that the Germans have always been prepared to build bridges and help. And that, in fact, is what Hitler was trying to do in the 1930s. And he had some success with it with Pilsudski when he was the Polish leader. But, you know, it's funny, Pilsudski told his those who were going to follow, you know, after him, gave them advice on being keeping things open with the Germans. And as soon as he died, they didn't follow that advice at all, and they went the other way. They went a different way. So it's kind of interesting why they did that. So she says the inefficient Polish economy is supported by German assistance and sums running into the billions, while the German population donates thousands of tons of food. This is in 1981. Before me is a copy of a document from the name of something from Katowice, dated 10 April 1981, in which the auxiliary bishop, Krzysztof Domen, chairman of the charitable committee of the Conference of Polish Bishops, and you need to realize that Poland is 100% Roman Catholic. Well, of course, there are some people there who aren't, but basically it's one of the most Catholic countries there is. And the church is very, very powerful there and influential. It used to, at this time it was, certainly. It confirms that 700 tons of food had already been received, intended for the people of his homeland. He also confirms that he is aware that he is dependent on assistance from neighboring countries. The assistance received from these neighboring countries is nevertheless alleged to be but a drop in the ocean. What this really means is, she says, send more. And we Germans do send more. This is a fact that Germans, after the war, were going all out to send aid and food and survival packages into Poland to help the Polish people, and so were other people doing it. They were getting help from all over the place, but it was never enough. Anyway, she says, you know, if they collect money to help Poland all the time, people fall head over heels all over themselves out of pure pity. Ecclesiastical institutions collect, schools collect, private persons collect, associations collect, proclamations to contribute are posted in hospitals and banks, and so on and so forth. You know, if you don't contribute at least 25 Deutschmarks per assistance package, it's not enough. You know, it's considered to be not enough. Germans contribute overwhelmingly to this Polish cause. Well, they were still, this must have been in West Germany and to the Poland that was still behind the Iron Curtain. What about East Germany? But the East Germans didn't need the kind of help that the Poles needed. Now let us investigate the testimonies of hatred of the Polish intellectual classes, which are the result of this ecclesiastical incitement since 1848. Local historian and scholar in Polish matters, Alexander Trajcia, in his book, History of German Culture of Ripon, Poland, and the Surrounding Regions, wrote, in the years of revolution, 1904 to 1906. We were always hearing that all Germans ought to be slaughtered in a single night. To slaughter the Germans from the cradle upwards was the slogan of the Poles at that time. But even in the time when our parents and grandparents were still children, during the 19th century, they often heard this horrible slogan about the slaughter of all the Germans, with which the Poles had obviously been indoctrinated for generations. And then there are the publications from the year 1929 in the Polish newspaper, League for Great Power, 3rd edition, quote, "In war against the Germans, there will be no prisoners and no room for human feelings. We will astonish the world with the unusual, the bloody victims exceeding human proportions with which we will wash away the shame of the insults which we have had to endure from the Germans. In the Polish army, we must bear the spirit of an irreconcilable struggle rising to the point of cruelty." This was in 1929. And I understand, ladies and gentlemen, that not everyone in Poland was writing things like this, that this was probably a kind of a paper that was more anti-German than most, you know, extremely so. But still, this kind of thing was going on all the time throughout Polish history. She says, in Posen, in 1921, it was possible to read the following on posters and in leaflets. Quote, "With this broom, we will sweep the last Germans from Poland." Now, in 1921. And now they had just gotten their Poland, you see. They got it in after Versailles, the war ended in 1918. I don't know when that was official. Probably took a while. So now they're a country, and now they're saying this. They're putting out leaflets. "We're going to sweep the last Germans from Poland." And the Germans were forced to be in Poland by the boundary makers. Any that are still there in July 1921 is German trash and will be slaughtered to a man. And the biggest Hakatists, which was what they called ethnic German Catholics, will be covered with petroleum and tar and set on fire and burned. Now they're all going to get it. All doctors, pastors, lawyers, leaseholders, settlers, property owners, and all kinds, whether German or Jewish. So they're putting Germans in the class with Jewish. And now, what does this kind of talk make you think of? It's exactly like the kind of extreme Jews who get carried away with their hatred against whoever it is that they're after. You know, that they talk like this. So it goes on. Here's a little more. The Pan-Slavic Youth Association on 4th May 1929 incited the people with the following publication. They wrote, "In 1410, the Germans were defeated at Tannenberg, but now we will smash them at Berlin. Danzig, East Prussia, Silesia are minimum demands." They want all these places. "Though through this gigantic victory, Poland will rule all of Europe." They did actually think like that. Some of them did actually, but it's not funny because they've been a huge, huge problem because of this personality trait that they have, if you want to call it that. So going on, the Polish professor Limanowski from Vilna was right when he said of his countrymen, "It lies in the nature of the Poles that they cannot remain in the realms of the real. Their fantasy reaches further. Whenever they get their hands on a piece of land, they want more. They want the whole world." And she writes, in fact, they do want the whole world. In June 1929, they gave further proof of it. Here's something else written in 1929. "The hour of freedom will soon ring for the historically Polish territories. The Pax Polonica will cause Europe to tremble. Fate has given Poland the historical task of forming the life of Central Europe." Well, it was actually true that Poland has for a long time been claiming that they should be considered the primary or main Slavic state and therefore to represent all Slavic people, and that they are the main Slavic European country of Europe, and they think that they should be recognized as a major power in Europe. They used to talk like that. I don't know what they're saying these days. Next, she writes, next to megalomania, what is recklessly revealed here is the Polish lust for robbery and murder, which breaks out in this people over and over again. The most shocking thing is that this minister of industry, the same one who wants to liquidate the residues of the remaining German population at whim, and who constantly brags that they are entitled to do so under morals and international law, bears a German name. He is obviously, now this relates to what Hitler and Himmler were talking about the Germans who become a part of another country, in this case, Polonized, and considers himself a Pole. So she writes, he is obviously a German, re-educated for centuries, as in many other cases as well. There are other cases of people like him. The Poles call that a German having risen in the Polish culture. An old proverb a few centuries old confirms this over and over, that men of our blood, she means German blood, who leave their country and apply their strength and skill to another people are lost to us. They not only become loyal citizens of the new country, but vanity and a need for validity drives them to become our bitterest enemies in 2 to 3 generations, sometimes even faster. For the most part, they do valuable cultural work, which the host peoples benefit by, but they themselves become renegades, culturally enriching other nations. Renegades always carry the poison sting of treason, and precisely for this reason, they become worse haters of their ancestry than if they were truly foreign to them. There are endless examples of this turncoat attitude in all countries of the world. The best known deniers of their German blood were Catherine the Great of Russia, who was the princess from Darmstadt, and the American General Eisenhower. And she spells his name in the German manner. Well, isn't that interesting? I didn't know enough about Catherine the Great to know that, although I know she became 100% pro-Russian. You know, I know that, of course, since she was the queen there and the empress, she should have been. But Eisenhower is a good example there, how he, like, said, how I hate the Germans. And it's known he was German. That happens. This is a phenomenon. So there's another part I want to read, moving on down quite a bit from what I took from there. Although there is no historical proof at all, the Poles represent their history as if they could look back on 1,000 years of existence of a Polish state. This part is a little bit about how the Poles have reinvented and do reinvent their history, and mostly take from what Germans did and say it was Poles. That's because that's mostly was Germans doing things in those lands. And so she continues, and the otherwise serious Germans help them in so doing, sometimes intentionally because they feel they need to help the Poles, or sometimes unintentionally. The first falsifier, as we have heard, was the German Wolf Gottlobonus, active as bishop in Krakow. But these falsifications alone wouldn't have had the devastating consequences if other Germans had not attempted to resurrect the otherwise forgotten Wends, W-E-N-D-S, as Slavs in the 18th century. Basic to the next swindle was the German theologian August Schlosser. He died in 1809, who, in the service of the Russians as historical and philological expert, in St. Petersburg, to please the Tsar, is said to have invented the word Slav. While investigating and systematizing the Glagolitic church language, Schlosser's invention influenced the theologist Johann Gottfried Herder, who made a name for himself by digging up old folk songs of various peoples, but especially those of the Slavs. He found the Wends and the Sorbs, S-O-R-B-S, in a culture of the Slavs. And she put Slavs in quotation marks, as though there was no such culture. But the Poles know that they owe him, this German theologist, Herder, since they show their gratitude to him the only example of Polish gratitude in history by maintaining his monument in a Morungen, East Prussia, the city of his birth. Well, Herder is considered to be a great German historian, too. And he's famous for collecting all these folk songs from the people of the East, the Wends and the Sorbs and the Slavs. I have a friend named Andreas Wetzerle, who was on my show a number of times, and he talked about this, and he's a great admirer of Herder. And he's very pro-German, but he's not anti-Slav, and so he contributes to this belief that Herder did a good thing. But she is saying that she's questioning this, and that that this is part of the way the whole Slavic thing has been invented, by taking these poems and songs and stuff and saying that they came from the Slavs. I can't speak to that. But she goes on, the Poles naturally need to fill out all their alleged 1,000-year history, and they do say they have a 1,000-year history, with great events and great men. Since no such great events or great men ever existed, they simply allocate to themselves all the great Germans they can find and describe them as Poles. I will only mention, she may be a little bit exaggerated here. They had some people, you know, leaders, winners of battles and so on, but that's about it. She said, I will only mention a few, the most outstanding, those that the whole world knows were Germans. The Poles, nevertheless, dare to list them as Polish. The Poles prefer to make themselves ridiculous rather than admit the truth. As long as they can brag, they figure sometimes they will be believed. So, the first one she mentions is Nicholas Copernicus. And Nicholas Copernicus was definitely a German, only ever spoke German, but he lived in an area that was Poland. So the Poles want to call him a Pole. Now, there's the German astronomer Johannes Hevelius. I don't know about him, but she says just because he was born in Danzig, they call him a Pole, but he was a German. And the sculptor Veit Stoss from Nuremberg, I know a lot about him, and it's true. The Poles say he's Polish and call him Witt Stwaj, because at the time when he created the great sculptures for the royal castle at Krakow, he naturally lived at Krakow. But by far the most sculptures that he did were in Nuremberg, and I saw a whole lot of his work in Nuremberg. I was amazed that there was so much there, in the churches that they were originally made for, and also in museums. He's one of my very favorite sculpts in wood. Amazing work, amazing genius. But these are things that are, you know, kind of irritate the way the Poles want to make these Germans into Polish people. And Veit Stoss also was born in Nuremberg, died in Nuremberg, lived most of his life in Nuremberg. He spoke German, never spoke Polish, but he did spend quite a number of years in Krakow doing a very large culture group for the crucifixion type thing for the royal castle there. She says, Poland received everything from the Germans, and this is the reason for their limitless hatred. Well, you know, whenever you bring that up, oh, they do. They go absolutely bananas. They hate to hear that. Naturally, they would, but she says they have an inferiority complex and don't realize it. Even their epic-making dictionary of the Polish language didn't come from them, but from the German professor and resident of Thorn, named Samuel Gottlieb Linde, a philologist who was a praeses and head of the Warsaw Lyceum. He lived from 1771 to 1847. He only learned Polish as an adult. And he is the one who compiled this famous Polish language dictionary for the Poles. They didn't even have their own person to do it. This is just a little smattering of what you'll find there. Most of it is accurate, I think. The facts are accurate, that's for sure. The factual part, she may have her own opinion in there, but she's fed up, you know? She's fed up. You get fed up with things like this. So the whole, I'm not going to go into any more from there. There's a lot, though, that I could. Oh, there's one last thing I'm going to read on this. Yeah, just very short. She writes, but even the reporter Zanowski let the cat out of the bag and revealed the Polish objectives and the Polish character when he declared, a Catholic German is not a true German. This sentence should be read several times and should not be forgotten, since this is an announcement of the next objective of the Poles, she says. Well, but just think about this, similar to that one above that I said you should think about, the where I started. A Catholic German is not a true German, because the Poles are all Catholic, and when this was said, they definitely, you know, were. They may have loosened up on their religion a little bit, like so many people have all over the world. But basically, they're the most loyal Catholics anywhere, and they're very proud of that. And so if they say, and there are Germans who are Catholic, but they're saying that if a German is a Catholic, then he can't be a German, because to them, the Catholic is God's choice. You know, God loves the Catholics. I mean, the true religion of Christ is Catholicism, always has been, always will be, and therefore, you know, Germans are not good enough to be. God wouldn't allow Germans, wouldn't recognize a German as a Catholic, and they also think that they are the perfect Catholics, and that the only real Catholics in the world are Polish Catholics. Yeah, you know, the only true Catholics are Polish. So a German can't be a Catholic. That's really kind of amazing. And it brings to mind that Jim Condit comes to my mind with this. And I had to look him up to remember his name, but he's a devout Roman Catholic, and he relates very strongly to the Poles. And it was a Polish man who gave him all this information he's got that he publishes, showing that Hitler was a rotten, no good bum who was even a traitor to Germany and so on. This is, it's all Polish scandal mongering and German hatred. And Condit spreads it around and then insists that he doesn't dislike Germans. No, he just dislikes the Third Reich, which was the best of modern Germany. Hitler made a speech at Posen on October 4th, 1943, and it's very well known. And it's the one that they use to say it proves that the Holocaust happened, or that the Germans were murdering people and in the East. And I'm not, though, going to go into that part of it, but I think I will do that on an upcoming program, because I've talked about this before, but I'd like to talk about it again. But I'm going to talk about another part of it. But the first thing I have to question is whether this speech is genuine at all. And Carlos, what I'm using is Carlos Porter's translation, which you can find at CODO, at the CODO.com library. You know, my concern is this speech has been challenged as to whether it's whether it's authentic, or whether it's just been tampered with, or whether it's the whole thing is fake, or maybe the whole thing is authentic, or is parts of it fake and parts of it tampered with and switched around and so on to give a different meaning to it. And there are reasons to have questions about it. Well, darn, I wrote to Carlos today and asked him. Oh, and here's his answer, which I forgot to look at. Forgot that I'd asked him. He said, I think it's authentic. This is from Carlos Porter. Whether it's been tampered with, I can't tell. But it doesn't prove much, if anything. I'll get back to you about this. Then here's some more. There's a recording of the whole thing, 2 hours, which I've listened to. See, I've never been able to hear that recording. But he says he has. It's very strange. He talks for 2 hours about the military situation and then inserts about 30 seconds about the Jews. Then people take a couple of uses of a single, rather unusual, vague word, Ausrottung, which has a wide range of meanings. Yes, we've talked about that a lot. So this is what I thought. I thought that the first part that I'm going to talk about is probably real. But when it gets into things that they can use to prove, to, you know, talk about killing people and so on, then I think that there's some evidence that some of it has been messed with, and it doesn't make much sense, some of the things he's saying. He's written quite a bit more here, but he's talking about something else that I'm going to be talking about, the Jews and so on, and I'm not going into that part of it. So the part that I'm going into is where he's talking about dealing with the Slavs and the Russians, because that's the theme of my program tonight. So he says, this is an excerpt from his speech, Himmler's speech, and he's talking to SS leaders, is what he's talking. He's got a whole bunch of them there, 100 or more or so, SS leaders. So he says, with regards to the situation as a whole, I am, as you know, an optimist. I know that we will win the war. That is a law of nature. I think he got that from Hitler's, calling it a law of nature. But I have always been rather conservative in my calculations, and I think I can show that I have never made a mistake in prophecy in these matters. I therefore believe that the Russians have lost approximately 2 million men in dead, prisoners, and disabled, in those who died, prisoners, and disabled. The Russians have lost approximately 2 million men. That's what's important. We must therefore expect one more desperate total offensive of the Russians in winter with a strength of 200 divisions, that is approximately 2 million men. He goes into this more than I'm giving here, but he said that the Russians have somehow, all going through the east and so on, found 2 million more men. So even though they've already gotten rid of 2 million, the Germans, they're going to have 2 million more to face, just like they're starting all over again, sort of. And Himmler says, we must and will hold off this attack and this clash. That's what he's telling them. We must do it. And because we must do it, we will do it. And he then says, you're tempted to say, it's hopeless, give up, there's nothing we can do. Well, there is something more in between there, but I'm just jumping to that. And Himmler says, when somebody tells you that, just hand him your hanky so he can dry his tears. Then he says, you hear the next prayer. This goes, we were wrong about the Russians. This song is usually sung by men from some eastern province who were over there in their youth, some of whom have written very good books and had a Russian mother too. And now they tell stories. It is also, Himmler's being a little, I don't want to use the word sarcastic, but he's trying to talk to these men very straight on, and he's skeptical about, he's saying that there's a lot of talk that makes Russians seem stronger than they are, or than we should think they are, and he thinks that this is not a good idea at all. So he says it is also sung by the little political vagabonds, whom we first came to know in the Eastern struggle against Poland, whom we rejected at home, and who have now been drafted as soldiers, officers, and majors, and are still peddling their intellectual poison under cover of the uniform of our decent German army. Goaded on by this propaganda tendency, I can't call it anything else, they tell you so many stories or write them home by military post, and the stories then trickle down from the top to bottom. Quote, yes, we were wrong about the Russians. The Russians are not at all the robot, this is the expression used most frequently, that we thought they were in 1941. Now that we're over here in the East, our eyes have been opened. The Russians are a noble people, and so on and so forth, a collection of all virtues. We just have to educate them as National Socialists. This is still Himmler talking. This is still Himmler's speech. But he's expressing what these people are saying. And these people are saying about the Russians, we just have to educate them as National Socialists. The best thing would be to create an NSRAP or something similar, like National Socialist Russian Workers' Party. Then they would, this is the next bit, form the Army of Liberation under General Vlasov. Then comes the following, which is a constant claim of General Vlasov. Quote, Russia can only be freed by Russians. Germany has so far never been able to defeat the Russians, unquote. So give Vlasov 500,000 or 1 million Russians, arm them well, train them insofar as possible, according to German principles, and Vlasov is so noble that he'll go off against the Russians and kill them for us. People can blow off a great deal of stuff and nonsense. That wouldn't be so dangerous. But when a piece of nonsense like this has the end effect that a glorious army, looking back on hundreds of years of tradition, like the German one, begins to doubt its own strength due to the gossip of politically untrained little officers of higher or lower service grades, the little bundle of proverbs who talks like this doesn't even notice how devastating it is when he says, quote, we cannot beat the Russians, they can only do that themselves, unquote. Then that is dangerous. Everybody you ask, how's the Russian infantry, will tell you with pathetic thoughtlessness, since the two things don't go together logically, after all, they say the Russian infantry is garbage, we are vastly superior to them, but Russians can only be defeated by Russians. I wouldn't have had any objections if we had hired Mr. Vlasov and every other Slavic subject wearing a Russian general's uniform to make propaganda against the Russians. I wouldn't have any objections at all. Wonderful. Now, as you can tell, what this is all about is the idea that they should have used Russians. And in this case, there's the idea that Vlasov, who had been captured and was in German custody, volunteered and wanted to fight against his own nation, that he had been just been a general for, and very successful one, and fight for the Germans, and he get a group of a division or something of Russians, and from all the Russian POWs and the White Russians and so on that were around there. This is Himmler's answer to this, and we already know that Hitler is skeptical about things like this, so Himmler was much more open to it. But this is what he's saying now, even though they're facing some very tough times here in 1943. So he goes on and says, our comrade Fegelein once captured a Russian general like that. Look, they're cheap. They're Slavs. Full of humor, as Fegelein is, Fegelein told his staff, we'll treat this one real good. We'll act like we're going to recognize him as a general. So when he comes in, stand up, stand at attention, keep quiet, say, General Sir this and General Sir that, show him how much respect you have for him. Of course, this worked. You don't need to give a Russian general any political ideas, political ideals, or political plans for the future. You can get them cheaper than that, gentlemen. The Slavs are known for that. The Slav is never able to build anything himself. In the long run, he's not capable of it. I'll come back to this later. With the exception of a few phenomena produced by Asia every couple of centuries, though that mixture of two heredities, which may be fortunate for Asia, but is unfortunate for us Europeans, with the exception, therefore, of an Attila, a Genghis Khan, a Tamerlane, a Lenin, a Stalin, the mixed race of the Slavs is based on a sub-race with a few drops of blood of our blood, Germanic blood, he says, blood of a leading race. The Slav is unable to control himself and create order. He is able to argue, able to debate, able to disintegrate, able to offer resistance against every authority, and to revolt. But these human shoddy goods are just as incapable of maintaining order today as they were 700 or 800 years ago, when they called in the Varangians, when they called in the Ruriks for help, for assistance, I take it. Every Russian, every Slav likes to hear himself talk. An old story. If you encourage them by saying, please tell us, we place the highest value on your opinion. After all, we can only learn from you. Then you won't find a single Russian commissar who won't fall for this. It's like tickling them with a peacock feather, just like this. Our Fegelein treated his general that way, and his general told us everything. that such a brave, courageous commander really shouldn't ever tell at all. Everything from his battery position to his divisional marching plans and orders, he had a whole offensive army. He gave us everything, ripe for the slaughter. It was clear in his mind that after all his blabbering, he was never asked anything directly, not with a single word, meaning he offered it all, that he really couldn't go back to little Father Stalin, even though he wore the Order of Stalin, number 700 and something, a sort of great knight's cross from over there, which he then gave Fegelein as a gift. Fegelein gave the medal to the Führer, and the Führer gave it back to Fegelein in a very nice silver box. Just thought I'd mention it. Now he returns to, he says, when Fegelein told me the story of the general, I said, sure, we can do everything. The man gets promised everything, and he'll get it, too. He gets the pension of a German lieutenant general. He's a Russian lieutenant general. He gets good food, liquor, women. That's really disgustingly cheap. A torpedo costs, what do I know, 10,000 marks as soon as we fire it. The preliminary concentrated artillery fire for a single division or corps costs many hundreds of thousands. We don't even know whether the fire will be as effective in every case as when we buy just one cheap Russian general. Well, he's going a little overboard here, I would say. But what he's making the case that they're not reliable, that he thinks he's trying to say that the Slavic nature, even though they seem to, you know, work for the Russians, they wouldn't work for us because we couldn't trust them. Basically, it's all about trust. But now he says, I'm going to skip this about the money down and everything. And he says it's really cheap if you get a Russian offensive army for it. You can do that with every Russian general, every one, if you can get hold of them, if you can capture them. We really shouldn't take them so seriously. If we could do that, then things would go right. But we Germans handle it so badly, I must say, in the state and the armed forces, that even many a party comrade has walked on that bird's lime and gotten stuck. Mr. Vlasov has made speeches in Paris, in Brussels, in Berlin. At his feet sat astonished members of the German leadership corps. Their mouths hang wide open, their noses fall right down into their mouths out of sheer astonishment. Quote, they say, golly, that Bolshevik can do simply everything. And they let that butcher's assistant tell them so. I took the trouble to read his whole speech once. I'll write an opinion on this speech. He's talking about Vlasov and send it to you in the near future. Mr. Vlasov says, it's a shame how the Germans treat the Russian people. We Russians abolished corporal punishment decades ago. Himmler says, sure they abolished it. That's why they shoot them now instead. That's just another kind of incentive. And he quotes Vlasov as saying, you Germans reintroduced corporal punishment. Oh, how barbarous, how low down. And Himmler says, everybody in the audience feels ashamed. A few minutes later, Vlasov claims, how nationalistic the Russians are. You must appeal to their nationalistic soul. Can't you just see how the victor over Field Marshal Paulus, he says, General X, I no longer recall his name. Well, I looked him up. It's General Konstantin Rolosovsky. And Himmler says this general was locked up by the GPU for years, beaten, whipped, and tortured, so that he suffers from his hip pain even today and has a severe head injury, was victorious over Paulus' Stalingrad out of pure nationalism. Well, this is a victorious Russian general over Paulus at Stalingrad, General Rolosovsky, and it's true what Himmler says, that he held senior commands until August 1937, when he became caught up in Joseph Stalin's great purge and accused of being a spy. In Rosakovsky's case, his association with the Special Red Banner Eastern Army and the intrigue surrounding Marshal Vasily Blücher, that's Russian, who was arrested shortly after Rokossovsky, and who died in prison without confessing, may have been enough to trigger his arrest. Rostakovsky, however, survived. Upon his arrest by the NKVD, his wife and daughter were sent into internal exile, where his wife, Julia, was forced to support their daughter by finding odd jobs, which she would lose when it was discovered that her husband had been arrested as a traitor. A cellmate said, those who refused to sign a false statement, this is all from Wikipedia on this Russian general. A cellmate said, those who refused to sign a false statement were beaten up as long as the false statement was not signed. There were steadfast people who stubbornly did not sign, but there were relatively few. K.K. Rostakovsky, as he sat with me in the same cell, did not sign a false statement. But he was brave and strong. He was a brave and strong man, tall and broad-shouldered. He, too, was beaten. So after he had spent those that time, which Himmler says was a couple years, in prison being beaten and so on, then they let him out again, and he was proving his worth by being a very tough general at Stalingrad. But the point that Himmler is making is to say that these Russian generals and so on are so nationalistic and fight hard out of nationalism. He's saying they fight hard out of fear of what's going to happen to them if they don't. And everything is out of fear, and that the Germans don't treat their people, their military people, or any people like that. So Himmler then says about this Vlasov saying what he's saying. Nobody contradicts, in his speeches and so on. Nobody contradicts him. I thought the Russians had abolished corporal punishment. He's saying that ironically. Apparently, among the Russians, only the generals are beaten to get better results out of them. This Vlasov ballyhoo has gone around Germany without contradiction. Instead of skillfully making propaganda out of it to disintegrate the Russian army, this propaganda has been turned against us and has to some extent paralyzed the strength of resistance and the will to resist of our own ranks through errors and false notions. And now he wants to talk about the Slavs some more and says, and now back to the Slavs. I consider it necessary to speak to each other about this once again. Whether it's Peter the Great or the late Tsars, whether it's Lenin or Stalin, they know their own people. They are perfectly well aware that the concepts of loyalty, never betraying, never conspiring, have no place in the Russian vocabulary. Whatever people may tell you about the Russians, it's all true. It's true that some of the Russians are fervently pious and fervently believe in the Mother of God of the Kazans or someplace else. It's absolutely true. It's true that the Volga boatmen sing beautifully. It's true that the Russian of today in modern times is a good improviser and good technician. It's true for the most part that he's even a lover of children. It's true that he can work very hard. And it's just as true that he is thinking lazy. It's just as true that he is an uninhibited beast who can torture and torment other people in ways a devil would never permit himself to think of. It's just as true that the Russian, high or low, is inclined to the perversest of things, even devouring his comrades or keeping his neighbor's liver in his lunch bag. It's all part of the scale of feelings and values of the Slavic peoples. It's often purely a matter of chance which lot he draws, and to people who don't know the beast, he is often a very great riddle. What is the fellow up to now? You know, a lot of these things, when they're brought up of what the enemy did to the Germans in this battle in the East, when they caught him, and the mutilation and the terrible tortures, people would say, well, that's the Jews, or that's the influence of the Jews, or the NKVD commissars were there and they made him do it, or that's the partisans, they were all Jews. They're always bringing that up. It's true about that, but Himmler is not saying it's the Jews. He's saying it's the Russians. He's often saying Slavs. When he says Slavs and he's talking about the Slavic peoples, he's basically referring to Russians, but some others too, I know, but I don't know that his mind is on those that they're fighting, not the ones they're not fighting. But there's a lot of them that they were fighting elsewhere too. So anyway, he goes on and says, the Russians themselves know each other very well and have invented a very practical system. Whether it was the Tsars with the Okhrana or Mr. Lenin and Mr. Stalin with the GPU or the NKVD. So here he's making it clear that, the Russians were always this way, even you know, under the Tsars. Russians get together with little father, little mother, and their little children. Not one of the four or five knows who is betraying whom at the moment. Which one is the informer betraying the father now? Is it the mother or the daughter? And who in return is betraying them? In doubtful cases, there may be two, even three, informers in this family. I am not exaggerating. This remark is entirely accurate with regards to the city. In the countryside, our comrades who have been over there in the east can confirm that there are still 20 or 30 NKVD informers and agents in every village, even after the withdrawal of the Bolsheviks. Even after the people withdraw and they come into the village and amongst those who are left there, there's still NKVD informers. And he's saying the number 20 or 30 left behind. And they don't leave, and you don't, and they're part of the village people. They're village people, and this is the point of this is the kind of informant network they had in Russia, and this started with the Tsars, and it continued with the Bolsheviks, and then the just the communists, I guess. You know that everybody was turned into an informer within families too, and they like to say that it was that way in Nazi Germany, that the Gestapo, the Nazis, encouraged and taught people to inform on their family members. And it's not true. It's not at all true. But it's always said it was actually, of course, the Bolsheviks that were doing it, and in Russia that happened. He says, this ensures to an absolute certainty that no conspiracy can get started, because everything will still be reported to the top by means of this informer apparatus. Then comes the pistol or deportation, and that is how this entire people must be governed. Notice he says not that they are governed, but they must be governed because they're not very governable. That's what he thinks. He says it is basically wrong for us to project our whole harmless soul and heart, all our good nature, our idealism onto foreign peoples. He's talking to them now as Germans, saying, you know, that as Elsa Loesser spoke too, that we Germans are good natured, we are helpful, we're not out to harm people. But we cannot think that other people are the same as we are. This applies to Herder. He's bringing up Herder, who I was talking about earlier. This applies to Herder, who wrote The Voices of the Peoples, probably in a drunken hour, and caused us, in later generations, such boundless suffering and misery, because it made the Germans think all these good things about the Slavs, I think is what he means there. He says that applies to the Czechs and Slovenes, to whom, after all, we brought their national feeling. They themselves were absolutely incapable of it. Rather, we invented it for them. As for the SS man, who he's talking to, one principle must apply absolutely. We must be honest, decent, loyal, and comradely to members of our own blood and to no one else. So I'm reading this because this applies to why the Germans had the attitudes in the East that they did, even elsewhere. He says, what happens to the Russians? Now, here you come with this kind of hard part, and I'm not sure I would say that what he means by it is, well, I'll just read it. What happens to the Russians, the Czechs, is totally indifferent to me. Whatever is available to us in good blood of our type, we will take for ourselves, that is, we will steal their children and bring them up with us if necessary. Whether other races live well or die of hunger is only of interest to me insofar as we need them as slaves for our culture. Otherwise, that doesn't interest me. Whether 10,000 Russian women fall down from exhaustion in building a tank ditch is of interest to me only insofar as the tank ditches are finished for Germany. Well, this is the part, this is a section that is used very much against Himmler and Hitler and the whole SS, and that they didn't care what they did to these people, and they wanted to use them as slaves for our culture. See, I think there's something wrong with that sentence, because the Germans never wanted to use foreigners as within their own culture and as slaves or anything like that, or even as servants, or they didn't want to. It was always we are the working people. You know, they did that during the war, when everybody was fighting in the war and they didn't have anybody to work on the job, so then they used people. But that's not what they wanted to do. But I think he may have said, we will steal their children, because he did talk that way. But what he meant, I don't know why he talked so. I don't know why he used that kind of language. But he seemed to use it in table talk, too. He said kidnap. He might have said that here, too. But he means, you know, we're going to take the good children away from them and bring them up ourselves, if they have good blood. And what he's saying is everything for Germany. We have to do everything for ourselves, because for our own interest, because we are under threat of death. You know, we are the ones who are fighting for our existence. And when we're fighting for our existence, we have to do whatever is necessary. I think what he's trying to get across here. But anyway, I would be more than willing to discuss that with people, you know, further. But I'm going to go on. We will never be, he says, we will never be hard and heartless when it is not necessary. That is clear. We Germans, the only ones in the world with a decent attitude toward animals, will also adopt a decent attitude with regards to these human animals. But it is a sin against our own blood to worry about them and give them ideals so that our sons and grandchildren will have a harder time with them. This is the way Hitler spoke, and this is, I think, Himmler, you know, got that and agreed with it and repeated it, the same kind of thing. And of course, the only ones in the world with a decent attitude towards animals. That's pretty true, because Germany was the first country to pass any kind of legislation to protect animals, and that was done by Hitler. They had a lot of laws to protect animals, and the others were very slow. Now countries do, but they didn't then. So he says that our children and grandchildren will have a harder time if we help to strengthen these people and help them reach their nationalistic goals, then our sons and grandchildren will have a harder time with them later. I mean, after going through all this fighting and shedding all this of our own blood and all of our own wealth and so on, but mostly the blood, and then we're going to turn around and build these people up so that they can turn against us again in the future. And see, that's the part that does make sense to me, makes a lot of sense to me. Then he says, Himmler says, when somebody comes to me and says, I can't build tank ditches with children or women, that's inhumane, they'll die doing it. Well, this is where, I should have added, and I even have it here, that Carlos Porter doesn't think children were ever used for digging ditches, and that this could have been added in this sentence. But anyway, then Himmler says, then I must say you are a murderer of your own blood, since if the tank ditches are not built, then German soldiers will die, and they are the sons of German mothers. That is our blood. So that's the thinking, you know. It's like if you can't, we're being attacked, we're going to be destroyed. We have to look to save ourselves first, and not even think about saving anybody else until we're in a position where they can't hurt us. So then he says, that is how I would like to indoctrinate this SS, and I believe have indoctrinated, as one of the holiest laws of the future. Our concern, our duty, is to our people and to our blood. That is what we must care for and think about, work for and fight for, and nothing else. Everything else can be indifferent to us. I wish the SS to face the problem of all foreign, non-Germanic peoples, particularly the Russians, with this attitude. Everything else is moonshine, is fraud against our own people, and an obstacle to earlier victory in the war. Well, he knows they're going to be facing this new, fresh 2 million fighting force, and whatever is still left from before. So he knows how tough it's going to be, and he's trying to talk to these men to not allow themselves to have any concern except for their own people, their own soldiers, their own troops. And Germans are famous for this, even up to the generals, you know, wanting to be fair, wanting to be decent, wanting to not hurt people unnecessarily. And he's saying, this is a battle to the, this is where we're facing our death here. And of course, Germany was murdered. Sometimes now I'm starting to accept and think that perhaps the Germans are spiritually destroyed and they can't come back. At least they're under such an heel, you know, that they can't stand up. But I do think that I agree that it's in the blood, it's in the genetics, and unless the genetics are destroyed through all this immigration and race mixing, then the Germans can always come back and be strong, but be what they are, what they always have been. But what they're doing going along with this is destroying the blood, destroying the genetics too, so that it won't happen. And to think that the whole German race would be destroyed is, to me, the most terrible thing. And nobody, you know, if you're German, nobody else matters except you German people if it comes to that. You're not going to be spending your time thinking about other people and how to be nice to them. No, I wouldn't. So let's see, I've got just a little bit here now. One more paragraph. I must have thought it was important for the theme, so I'll say, one thing is a matter of course in this war, Himmler says. It is better for a Russian to die than a German. If we use the Russians, then they must be mixed with Germans in a ratio of 1-2 or 1-3. So now he's not absolutely ruling out using Russians, but he's saying how it has to be done. 1-2 or 1-3. The best thing is to use individual Russians. Then you can drive with them in a tank. One Russian with two or three Germans in a tank. Magnificent. Nothing wrong. But you must never let one Russian meet other tank driving Russians. Otherwise, the boys will conspire. But if you wish to have Russian-only companies for some reason, then be careful, gentlemen. And that is not just a thought, gentlemen. That is an order, gentlemen. They must have their informer apparatus, their NKVD, in this company. Then you can sleep in peace. That is, I guess he means that there has to be informers among them, and then they'll inform on who's doing what. I'm not real clear about that, but otherwise, he says, this is one of the earliest warnings I've issued. Take care that these subhumans, he should call them undermen, but he called it subhumans, always look at you. Make sure that they always look at you. They must always look there. Of course, some of these people they did think were subhuman. He said they must always look their superior in the eye. It's like with animals. As long as an animal looks his tamer in the eye, he won't try anything. But have no doubt about one thing. He is a beast. We will be able to utilize the Russians with this attitude. With this attitude, we shall be superior to the Slavs at all times, but not with any other attitude. Okay, so he's saying, if we deal with these people, we have to protect ourselves because they're unpredictable, like an animal, and you got to make sure that they're listening to you and they're following you, and they have to look you in the eye and so on. And otherwise, if you're too loose with them, they'll turn into beasts and they'll do beastly things to you. So you have to be very, very strict and control them at all times. And he says this is the attitude you have to have to the Slavs. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I was even going to talk some about Germanization I'll have to do that at a later time. The point that I was trying to get across here was that all these, what you can call them, accusations about Hitler being anti-Slavic and the National Socialists being anti-Slavic, and that they hurt themselves by doing so, is to not to say that they weren't, but to say why they were to the extent that they were, why it was, what they really thought, and that there was, you know, method in it, there was intelligence in it, there's reasoning in it. There's no doubt that they see the Germanic as the leading race and as the superior to the Slavic race, if I can call them races. No doubt about that. But that they wanted, that they hated them or something, no, but they wanted to protect themselves from them, and they felt that if they didn't see them the way they thought they really were, with all their failings and so on, that they would end up being victim to them. And the other thing I wanted to bring out was the idea of who are our brothers, who are our comrades, who are those like unto ourselves. And it was clear that Germans could work with a lot of Slavic people and even thought well of them and did work with them, but not the Russians. Hitler always thought the Czechs, Poles, and Russians were the biggest problems. Particularly he never thought well of the Russians, and he's spoken a lot about them, and Himmler has said quite a bit in this section about it. Now, you have to remember the time and the place and what was going on then. Of course, that had a whole lot to do with it. But the idea is, are these two groups of people very different, or are they not very different? How well can Germanic, Western European Germanics work with Eastern European Slavs? That's the question. And I don't think it's ever been really tested out in the fact that it's mostly the West helping the East one way or another. Thanks very much for listening tonight. This is Carolyn Yeager on the Heretics Hour on October 20th, 2014, saying good night.